Welcome to Sunstone Panel 335, Mormonism and Radical Politics. This panel is sponsored by the Mormon Worker Collective. My name is Jason Brown. I'm a contributor and editor for the paper. We have papers in the back and also a flyer for our potluck on Saturday or tonight at 7. So please pick that up and you're all invited. Briefly, the Mormon Worker has been in publication since 2007. And it's a newspaper journal devoted to ideas of Mormonism and radical politics. A radical perspective on Mormonism and a Mormon perspective on radicalism, as I like to say. We will have... This is getting kind of feedback-y. Hopefully... So we'll have four presenters today, and if it's all right, I'll introduce them, not all at once, but as they come up to speak. And hopefully there'll be enough time for Q&A, and we can get down to what we mean by Mormonism and what we mean by radical politics. And I look forward to the discussion. First up, we have Corey Bushman. She is one of the founding members of the Mormon Worker and a peace activist and human rights activist, and works as an advocate for victims of domestic violence and the homeless population. She's a graduate from the University of Utah with a BA in history with an emphasis on Eastern Europe. She more specifically studies pacifist communities within the context of the Soviet Union. Corey?
Hello. When I originally submitted my paper, it was specifically about Kazan Tolstoyans. And if you read the little excerpt that I submitted, they're a group of people that were followers of Tolstoy's religious thought, which is exclusively based on the Sermon on the Mount. Not exclusively, but that's primarily what it is. It's this idea of true Christianity that he developed later on in his life, which I'll talk more about. However, I've done a lot of research on Tolstoyans, but I've never done... until now, research combining the idea of Mormonism and Tolstoyans, and kind of what the if there's history, which it turns out there is some history with Tolstoy and Mormonism. So my thoughts have kind of shifted to more of this idea that as Mormons we're familiar with the United Order, but we're less familiar with other egalitarian communities that took place in the 19th century. And I believe, kind of within this idea of nurturing faith that we're talking about at Sunstone, I believe that studying these communities can be just as faith-promoting as studying our own Mormon history and heritage. So just to begin with, I'm just going to kind of go through the history of Tolstoy himself and Mormonism. So recently there's been some articles... in the Deseret News, the...
What?
Actually, I like this better.
It goes.
I'll just stand here and make sure it doesn't...
Okay. So like I was saying, there recently was an article in the Salt Lake, or the Deseret News, in the Mormon Times section, talking about this linkage that Tolstoy had a copy of the Book of Mormon. So I'm going to kind of go through a little bit of that first. So Tolstoy was first introduced to Mormonism in 1857 in Western Europe. He was on a train in Switzerland, and he met a 30-year-old man that told him about Mormonism. In Tolstoy's diary, there's three words recorded, well, four words, and they're all spelled in English, but all incorrectly. There's it says Utah, Joss Smith, and Lynch Law were just the three words that he recorded. And then...
I think there are other people trying to adjust lights in other rooms.
Okay.
Or ghosts, one of the two.
So, a few days after he recorded those words in his journal, he expanded a little bit, and he wrote, "Mormons in Utah, Joss Smith, their founder, killed by Grinch Law." So, that was his first introduction to Mormonism. 4 weeks later, he met a missionary in Geneva. But he doesn't record a lot about that interaction in his journals. And then it wasn't until 1887, 30 years later, that George Kanan, the American journalist, came and interviewed Tolstoy. And at this time, Tolstoy expressed a sympathy for Mormons. It was during the anti-polygamous campaigns that were going on. And George Kanan published his sympathies for Mormons in this article. Well, this article was read by Susa Young Gates, who was serving a mission in Honolulu. And just a kind of a really quick history on Susa Young Gates. She's the second daughter of Brigham Young's 22nd wife, Lucy Bigelow Young. She was a women's rights advocate, also a publisher, missionary, temple worker. She spoke at the Women's Congress. The title of her speech was "Equal Moral Standards for Men and Women." She had tea with Susan B. Anthony and Queen Elizabeth as part of this delegation for women's rights. And then she also kept correspondence with people like Charlotte Perkins Gilman, who's also was a socialist, a women's rights advocate, and a writer. And so, anyway, her correspondence, she had some correspondence with Tolstoy. And in her first letter to him, she complimented him on his extensive reading and knowledge. She was really surprised that he had any idea of, you know, who Mormons were or what they were going through at the time. In her letter, she wrote, "It would please me to forward to your address a copy of that book, so much maligned and abused, but withal so simple and sweet, called by your enemies the Golden Bible, by ourselves the Book of Mormon." So, Tolstoy's daughter, Tatiana, replied to her letter, which was fairly common for his correspondence, that his daughter would do some of that work. And she sent a Book of Mormon and then The Life of Joseph Smith by George Buchanan to Tolstoy. The inscription in the Book of Mormon simply read, "Count Leo Tolstoy from Susa Young Gates, Salt Lake City, Utah." And there's no other notes on the pages, so there's some... We're not really sure if he read the book thoroughly or if he just read parts of it. There's some record in his journal that he read it, but that doesn't mean that he read it in the entirety. He was known for writing notes on pages of books, and so they don't really think that he read it all the way through. Another thing I thought was interesting about her correspondence was... this was directed toward Tatiana. It said, "There is among us a paper published and edited by woman, the woman's exponent, for you must know that we are very progressive in our views on the woman question, having advocated women's suffrage for years." And then the last kind of interaction that they, or historical piece that was recorded is on January 1st, 1889. In Tolstoy's journal, he wrote, "A beautiful letter from an American woman." So Tolstoy's reaction to the Book of Mormon, from what we can tell, was fairly skeptical. Intellectually, he rejected it, but he had emotional acceptance for it. So let's see. So this kind of brings us to probably the story that we're most familiar with, which is this interaction that Thomas J. Yates, who was an LDS man that was studying at Cornell University, had with a person by the name of Dr. Andrew D. White, who was the U.S. foreign minister. And this is the idea that we get Tolstoy calling Mormonism the American religion. So in this interaction, it's said that Tolstoy made this great prediction, which is, if Mormonism is able to endure unmodified until it reaches the third and fourth generation, it is destined to become the greatest power the world has ever known. But there's a lot of, from everything that I've read, we're not really sure if he ever said that or if some of this has been embellished. Because Thomas J. Yates didn't record this interaction until 39 years after it took place. And Andrew D. White didn't tell J. Yates this information until 6 years after the interview with Tolstoy. So regardless, he was really sympathetic to religious commitment, but his concern was above all for personal individual belief. So this kind of brings us to Tolstoyans as a community of people who followed these beliefs of Tolstoy's. So just generally, their belief was that God is accessible to all men, regardless of their social class, their race, and that the celebration of his presence might take many forms. So, but he believed that it was an intensely personal experience. So it wasn't an organized religion, but it had the idea that if you lived this way, that it would be based on free accord by truth and by brotherly love for one another. In all the research that I've done on Tolstoyans, there's actually only one thing that I've ever seen recorded on Mormonism. And I think it's kind of interesting. It's just that they would sit around and they would sing. And they would sing hymns from all different faiths. And one Tolstoyan recorded that they would sing Mormon hymns because they were unusually musical people. So I thought that was kind of interesting, even at that time, that they would have access to that. So kind of going back and forth, just a really also a quick kind of history of Tolstoy and how he came to this place. As most of us know, he was fairly affluent, and within the context of Russian society, he owned a lot of land, he had servants, he had this, you know, big family. And in the 1870s, he found himself in a huge state of depression and was suicidal. And through research of various philosophers, including Buddha, he converted to Christianity. So he was raised in the Russian Orthodox Church, but it wasn't until this time that he actually converted to Christianity. And he reported, "I see now that if I did not kill myself, it was due to some dim consciousness of the invalidity of my thoughts." So he repeatedly testified that he was saved from death due to his conversion to Christianity. After this, he started spreading his beliefs and was excommunicated by the Russian Orthodox Church in February of 1901. Even after his death in 1910, the church labeled him as a heretic and he wasn't given a burial site. His philosophy spread first to the intelligentsia and then to the peasant communities that he associated with. At this time, his religious works were censored, and if any of you have seen the movie The Last Station that just came out, they kind of villainize his secretary, Vladimir Chekhov, in the film. But he was very loyal to Tolstoy and had great influence he had a lot of influence over the destiny of the Tolstoyans, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But he was on a committee for conscientious objectors in the Soviet Union after the revolution, and he helped to save a lot of Tolstoyans' lives. So, okay, I only have 5 minutes, so I'm going to kind of skip a lot of this. So the Tolstoyans, kind of their primary thing that I'll talk about is this idea of pacifism, which as members of the Mormon Worker Collective, we feel like the doctrine of the church really states very clearly this idea of that war is bad and that we should be proclaiming peace, which is found in the Doctrine and Covenants 98:16, among other places. So a lot of the Tolstoyans refused to participate in military service. And but what I thought was really interesting is that they believed that every person should act in accordance to their own conscience. So there was one Tolstoyan in particular that he did not refuse when he was called up to go. And another, a friend of his wrote, "We had no binding obligation about this matter, and indeed we could not have had any. Everyone acted freely as best he could according to the state of his own soul." So there's an article that I wrote about the Tolstoyans, so I'm going to skip this part that kind of led to their downfall, but it was due to, after Lenin died and Stalin came into power, he implemented these collectivization mandates, which basically obliterated any communes that were in existence. A lot of them were imprisoned for being war resistors. And so by the 1930s, they were basically non-existent. But I think more than anything, just in conclusion, one thing that I think that is really shared with like our history of Mormonism is this emphasis and importance placed on memory and history. And one Tolstoyan wrote, "Every effort must be made to resurrect Tolstoyan memory from the darkness of that compulsory silence." So even when they were given rehabilitation after Stalin died, they were asked not to share their experiences. And so there's this strong emphasis on memory and history. And I think just in closing, this is the last thing, is just this. Dr. Andrew White, the person that interviewed or spoke with Tolstoy, and shared this big prediction that Mormons would succeed if they didn't alter their beliefs. So, I mean, that's something that we've heard, and I think it was at BYU at one of their firesides that was shared, that story. But I think what's more important is Dr. White's comment that he made back to Tolstoy, and I'll just read this. It's, "I answered that Mormonism could hardly be judged by its results at present, that as a whole, the Mormons are, no doubt, the most laborious and decent people in the state of Utah, but that this is their heroic period. When outside pressure keeps them firmly together and arouses their devotion, that the true test will come later when there is less pressure and more knowledge, and when the young men who are now arising to begin to ask questions quarrel with each other and split the whole body into sects and parties." So I think that prediction, kind of going back to this idea of maturing faith, is more relevant to us in this day and age to kind of look at what that looks like. So I think that's all I'm closing.
Thank you, Corey. Next up we have Katie Savage, who is a recent graduate of the University of Utah's Environmental Humanities Master's Program and is an alumnus of Brigham Young University. As a fifth-generation Utah Mormon, Katie's life goal is to nurture orchards, dairy goats, and radical community consciousness on her home grounds.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Corey, for sharing your research. I'm just overjoyed to think of Tolstoy and seeing "Put Your Shoulder to the Wheel" together. I am a feminist who's haunted by Mormonism, its scriptures and its voices and its communities. And I've fought Mormonism's influence tooth and nail, like it's a disease I'm dying from. Its dogged insistence on gender duality, its clear male-only command and obey hierarchy, its rhetoric of women's importance in the domestic sphere, and its global reach. I have also fallen completely in love with the quirks of this religion, which runs in me five generations deep. I feel like I'm sewing up a trousseau made of my grandmother's rags and other women's charred bras. I'm making lemonade out of Stockholm Syndrome. The words and ideas and lives of Mormons continue to open up for me terrifying gaps in my feminist ideology, and this leaves me a bit of living space for a fruitful and radical restructuring of both my ideology and my faith, so that's rarely comfortable. Let me list some of the ghosts which haunt me. Some hauntings speak in the voices of my two Mormon sisters and my mother, who have spent their lives bathed in the rhetoric of the importance of women's work for families and societies, and when economically empowered women advise them to leave their kids in daycare and go to work in order to find satisfaction and liberation, they respond that they consider their work in the home as far more important and meaningful than the average desk job, where they'd be forced to do the bidding of a boss. And they believe they have some kind of autonomy in their home, which they would be stripped of in the workplace. Their responses have been very frustrating to me, but at times they can also clarify the startling deadness of our wage-earning lifestyle that we've been deeply socialized to take for granted as our birthright. Their words belie the frank drudgery of most activities in the labor sphere, work which really only makes sense if you see the world in dollar signs or if you're desperate, and which can't ever compare for them with the labor which they feel they've freely chosen to do among family, the creation, nurturing, and socialization of young, loved humans. The second haunting comes in the form of the as-yet-unembodied spirit of a future Mormon female prophet, up at the pulpit, a fulfillment of my wildest Mormon feminist dreams. She is, like the vast majority of our highest religious leaders, a white person. Even if she were a woman of color, she certainly comes from the ruling class, and we expect her to comport herself accordingly. She is finely coiffed and wearing a well-fitting suit, a suit woven by the women in the maquiladoras of Juarez, Mexico, femicide capital of the world, where many of the recovered bodies bear the wounds of rape and torture, their blood fortunately never staining the objects they create, which we can buy on the cheap. The prophetess raises children, but she does not waste her time on many of the other tasks which constitute globally women's work, such as subsistence food production, textile making, electronics assembling, and other forms of basic production for families and communities. Such productive work is done for her. Her food and her flowers, her clothing and machines are largely born in the hands of working men and women in poor countries, given up in exchange for desperation wages. Her medicines and skin creams are extracted from the richly biodiverse forests where women in the global south have spent their lives protecting and maintaining them. Rather than producing needed materials for herself and others, our prophetess produces what all our religious leaders do: commands for others to obey. The true test of our success as feminists is if she has the moral and social capital to boss around as many people as a man in her position can. The gift of these hauntings is to reel me back painfully to a re-examination of leadership, parsing out what a Christian leader would actually mean. We all know Jesus' insistence that the servant of all is the true leader. So in Matthew, he says, "Whosoever will be great among you, let him be your ministers. Whosoever will be chief, let him be your servant." Or there's Luke, the kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. But ye shall not be so. He that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief is he that doth serve. For 2,000 years, this has been a bad joke. We have taken the same bullies, the privileged alpha males, and clothed them in a rhetoric of servitude. Just as the Gentiles called their kings benefactors, if you're a political boss, you're a public servant. If you're a church president, you're the Lord's humble servant, sacrificing for the saints. But when Jesus wanted to show what he meant by equating leadership and servitude, he didn't lecture to a packed assembly hall where everyone stood for his entrance and exit. He washed shit off feet. He demonstrated what he meant about leadership by acting like a mother or even a maid. Since then, we have occasionally tried to curb human hubris by advising that people in the position to command others should be good listeners and shouldn't work for their own glory. We Mormon feminists are wise to the difficulty of this task, bearing on our bodies and psyches the scars of unrighteous dominion from men that got a little authority, as they suppose. What both feminists and Mormons constantly overlook is a far simpler and more elegant solution. What if we take Jesus not as giving cautionary recommendations to the already powerful, but rather as telling us to look to the people who are already doing the most unrequited direct service for others and decide that they are our leaders and our prophets? This means, to me, that mothers and women in the global south cultivating our food, holding together families, communities, and ecosystems would be recognized as the ones who can most fully teach us the nature of reality and the ones that we need to be listening to. The Mormon hierarchy itself asserts that the real selflessness of mothers and women in our communities makes their labor far more important than men's labor. And what if instead of dismissing their words as empty chivalry, we admitted that they're right? It is more important to care for young humans than to broker stock deals. And so why would we spend any more time listening to or paying men at a pulpit when we haven't spent enough time learning the stories and needs of so many others that have proven themselves more capable of caring for ourselves and others? If nothing else, this tactic would be the quickest way to stop the oppressors from rounding off the facetious praise of women. I am deeply indebted to a rich history of feminist voices within Mormonism, but it's time that we open ourselves more fully to a real consideration of women's lives outside of our overconsumption bubble, and make as our ideological focus these de facto housewives of the world who are charged with forever feeding and clothing us. The logic of both a consistent feminism and a consistent Mormonism should incessantly push us to see the most oppressed, the servant girl, the prostitute, the peasant, the one giving more than can ever be returned to her. The woman crossing the Arizona to have a chance to work cleaning public restrooms for a boss who sexually abuses her so she can send a few dollars back to her family. Or the Kenyan women in the Greenbelt movement growing forests in deserts and being jailed and beaten for protecting those forests. Or I would also posit our Mother Earth, the most abused among women, providing for our needs every minute in exchange for our unspeakable, flippant cruelty of her. These are the stories which we must begin telling each other every month in visiting and home teaching sessions. The stories that should be written and revisited, that should provide the foundation for our hymns and our girls' camp mottos. Typically, when we feminists do remember our sisters in poorer countries, we speak as if they're tragically behind us and only need to catch up, become equally capable of becoming CEOs and army generals, with an SUV in every driveway and a cell phone in every purse to ensure freedom of movement and communication. But making such women our leaders and prophets requires of us an openness to the possibility that we have a wrong-headed notion of reality, of the good life, and even of feminism. Here I'm indebted to eco-feminists such as Vandana Shiva of India, and Maria Meiss and Veronica Benholt Thompson of Germany, who have really bucked the academic trend of academic feminism and have dedicated to their lives to what they term the view from below. And they explain the view from below this way. This means that when we look at reality, when we want to gain clarity about where to go and what to do, we start with the perspective of women, particularly rural women and poor urban women in the South. Further, we start with everyday life and its politics, the strategy of women to keep life going. This view from below enables us to demystify the delusions created by those on top, that their life and their lifestyle are not only the best possible ones, but also the image of the future for everybody on this planet. This demystification helps us to see that this so-called good life is possible only for a minority, and moreover, that it is at the expense of others, of nature, of other people, of women and children. The voices which these women document bring us back to earthly reality. The earth is a place where responsible adults provide for themselves and clean up after themselves, where life only continues with food and water and air, and these things only exist because we work for them and we protect them. The notion of the good life that emerges is thus not one of pampered princesses and princes, but of real workers. In addition to egalitarian relationships between men and women, the good life includes food sovereignty, the continued ability to control vital resources rather than being beholden to global supply lines, militaries, and transnational agribusiness corporations. The good life includes strong communities and traditional forms of resource production and sharing, such as communal land holdings, which are currently threatened by neoliberal politics. The good life requires reproductive sovereignty, rejecting both forced sterilization and harsh anti-contraceptive policies by either their own governments or others. The good life includes a beautiful and healthy environment, which excludes the destruction of land bases for the sake of quick profits for foreign corporations. When we listen to these stories, when we allow them to shape our concept of reality as coming from our prophets, we have the real charge of sustaining such prophets. And I believe that the raised arm for sustaining is first of all an embrace, a sisterhood solidarity between the real workers of the world and a consecration of sharing of resources. The raised arm for sustaining is thus also a fist, rejecting not only patriarchy, but cutthroat plantation capitalism, the wage system, racism, environmental destruction, and corporate control of the world's resources. The raised arm is a working arm that holds a shovel, a quilting needle, a canning jar, and the old Mormon penchant for self-provisioning and material sovereignty as we begin to wean ourselves off of our material dependencies on conspiring men in the last days, which it takes a clear definition of transnational corporations, who are raping our Mother Earth, killing birth itself through species extinction, demolishing cultures and languages, stirring up resource wars, blueprinting empire, and through it all, making the lives of many women very, very difficult. I want to be clear about this point, that a revolutionary feminist anti-racist housewifery carried out by men and women and those who identify themselves as something other requires a greater engagement to the basic production of our own goods rather than demanding that those less privileged do drudge work for us. Standard feminism has fought the capitalist insistence that factors such as money and titles are the ultimate sources of life and power, and biological sources like wombs, agricultural land, or fertile wildlands are inherently harmful and disempowering. I pretty much daily witness this mentality, as I'm a woman with the life plans of farming to feed myself and my loved ones. A farm presents to me an opportunity to really tie myself to the sources of life, to have the power of food and material sovereignty, and yet people treat my ambition as a joke or an anachronism. They snidely wish me good luck trying to make a living doing that, trying to make a living dealing with living beings rather than dead wages. The work that I want to do is considered unskilled labor, whereas sitting at a desk is something that requires skill. Maria Meese asks, how did this alienation between people and their work develop to the point that the most lifeless thing of all, money, is seen as the source of life, and our own life producing subsistence work is seen as the source of death? I believe that to keep both feminism and Mormonism vibrant, we have to squeeze out from under the white supremacist heritage that we've been given and cease speaking from the narrow constraints of the middle class of the global north. The concerns and interests of women in the South should occupy us more than the potential goodies or ills that can be handed down to us from the white man at the podium. This will change how we can speak of the domestic and the public sphere. Our work as feminists will be to insist that these are indistinct. They're as indistinct as the acts of nurturing from acts of protecting and providing, which if you think about it, it's bizarre to separate those three. That when we obey a boss, we are still simply acting out the 1950s good wife, and that we can put our houses in order in a radically political manner. Drudge work is work that is coerced upon us by a patriarch who can be male or female, whether a husband or boss or bishop or police officer. Nurturing is important chosen creative labor, whether with one's own children, the potato field, or the world's forests, and whether our tools are an oven, a paintbrush, or compost. For long enough, women's crucial labor, like the labor of men, has been in the service of hierarchy, creating, nurturing, and socializing good workers and good soldiers, producing goods to be had for free or on the cheap by the abusers. When we rebel from this and enter the workforce, we do, in the words of Cindy Lirondelle, we warehouse children so that parents can do jobs that exploit other people. I don't believe that this is inherent to the nature of work. What the hauntings of Mormonism can push us to, as feminists, is to reclaim nurture work as revolutionary work, nurture that also protects and provides for those we love and for women all over the world. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judy. Next up, we have Tristan Call, who is a cultural anthropologist trying to plant a second foot in biological anthropology or agroecology. He graduated from BYU in 2008 and is doing ethnographic work in Guatemala and political work here in Utah.
Okay, really quick first, I'm going to be passing this around because it's worth doing some good work while we're learning as well and talking to each other. You don't have to sign it, but Katie and I have been working with a peasant union in eastern Guatemala, who is one of their main organizers, has been a political prisoner for about a year and a half now. And if you're interested in freeing him, just sign that and you can do a little tiny piece. Good point here, so.
Microphone.
All right. So. I'm going to be splicing together a couple of different things, and so there's parts that will be slightly more coherent than others. I hope you'll forgive that. Okay. The first thing I want to mention, on the Mormon Worker blog, which you can feel free to visit, we post things now and then about things we're working on. We had someone who is referred to on the internet as a troll, who provokes and creates debates and belittles the people that are trying to create the content on the blog. Right? His name was Son of a BC Rich. He taught me something that I think is really important that is going to sort of frame this conversation for me, I think, which is that we were debating immigration. And he consistently, and I finally realized, very pointedly was using pronouns to frame the conversation for himself. He was using words like we and us and they and them. This is something everybody here is familiar with, right? In order to describe the differences between we, you know, Utahns or North Americans who need to get a good deal out of the international economy, and them, people that are migrating in order to get a good deal themselves, and separating them into two categories, right? In my academic work right now in Nashville, Tennessee, I have professors very consistently warn me off of something that they call identity politics. Basically, the idea of creating unnecessary divisions between races and genders and classes in order to sort of help along the ruling class in dividing us and conquering us. And the tactic there being something that I think is described very, very well by Katie, the identity politics potentially of a successful middle class feminism and Mormonism. Being, you know, putting a female CEO in charge of conquering others or something like that. This paper, I'm arguing the primacy of identity. I think that, and maybe more specifically, the part of identity that involves boundaries, where self-boundaries lie and where other boundaries start. Because I think that that's the crucial foundational point for radical social change. So that's the frame for this. Now I'm going to read the paper I wrote. 1. My family is illegal. When I returned home from Guatemala in 2006, I learned that the state of Utah was outlawing my father. Of course, in the exclusionary parlance of Utah politics, Alonzo was already illegal. Before arriving in Provo, he had scooted under a chain-link fence and spent 3 days crossing the Arizona desert on foot. Back in Guatemala, before we left for Utah, in our respective ways, me on a 4-hour flight, he on a multi-week trek, I remember Alonzo sitting me down and explaining why he was leaving his family to work in the United States. He laid out his finances, explaining the mounting debts and the business that failed after thieves cleaned out their market stall in the middle of the night. He predicted what the border crossing would be like and how many years he expected to have to work in order to pay off his loans and return home to Guatemala. That was my last night in Guatemala, and by then Alonzo had become my father. During my first vulnerable months out of the country as an 18-year-old anthropology student, I lived in his home and shared his tortillas and helped push start his pickup truck. I played early morning soccer with his sons after their seminary class at the Mormon chapel, and I went up to him for advice when my own religious doubts and hopes started chasing each other in circles. Counseling was a role he was used to. He had been both the town's mayor and its Mormon bishop. Now, as he readied himself for a journey to Utah, he was offering himself to the uncertain hospitality of a people he felt some kinship with, but had never met outside of the ever-present LDS missionaries who lived in a room of his house, and a handful of college students like me. In 2006, hoping for kinship seemed naive, next to the harsh reality of legislation that would exact 5 years in prison for me, for helping Alonzo to, quote, reside or remain in the United States. Alonzo himself, of course, had already been outlawed as a person, which hopefully raises its own theological red flags, but laws against assisting migrants take things a bit further. The basic daily acts of kinship become illegal, giving up a spare couch to a father's tired body, offering clothing to a brother, breaking and sharing bread with a stranger, offering encouragement or money or prayers. And the very concept of family at the core of Mormon theology and eternal purpose becomes an enemy of the state. My personal experience taught me to rely on Alonzo as a father. And my church's theology whispers that he is my brother. But the police insist that he remain a stranger. 2. Family is the training camp of resistance. Kinship among our most basic moral urges and practical needs clashes with the coercive power of the state to divide us and thus becomes a rebel activity. This should not be as surprising as it sounds. For most of us, what we do at home is probably our most thoroughly ingrained example of an alternative to dominant economic and political structures. If your 7-year-old son is hungry, you feed him, not tell him to stop freeloading and get a job. When your uncle gets old and has macular degeneration, you drive him to his optometrist appointments. You don't fire him from your family for being unproductive and hire a new, more efficient uncle. In the case of my family, my sister still got just as good an education, just as nice toys for Christmas, and equally excellent health care as the rest of us, even though she was born in a foreign country, Germany, while my parents were overseas. Capitalist relations of calculated costs and benefits have obviously infiltrated family dynamics a bit, but not enough to totally root out the affection, sharing, and generous nurturing that, after all, family is supposed to evoke. If these family sentiments were universally applied, it would seem that there would be no greater threat to relations of domination. Private property, class inequality, nationality, international war, representative government, prisons, environmental injustice, etc. And there would be a considerable precedent for alternative modes of economy and governance that don't depend on capitalism or coercion. Communal property, mutual aid, solidarity with or among the oppressed, thrift for the common good. It's in this sense that family is at once the most conservative and liberal of institutions, conservative in the sense of an eternal devotion to conserving family solidarity and collective identity in the midst of an individualist, alienating, and consuming society, and liberal in the sense of generously and optimistically extending that devotion beyond clan boundary. Rather than seeing conservative and liberal urges as opposite, we can understand them as two integral elements of a project for universal kinship. 3. Civil religion and how it amputates kinship. Anyone familiar with mainstream Mormon politics knows that in most cases, radically universalist understandings of family are more a latent potential than a current reality. Civil religion, obedience to the state elevated to religious zeal, trumps kinship in state and federal politics, and in plenty of personal politics as well. For example, compare these two sections of a letter from my aunt in response to the question that I emailed her in preparation for this about her experience in the church and the doctrine of all being spirit brothers and sisters and how that had affected her views toward illegal residents in her community. This is one of her quotes. Having a belief of, quote, universal kinship serves to help me look at others with more of an attitude that we're all family, and family takes care of each other. This is how Christ taught us. For those who don't have that belief system, there could be a tendency toward exclusiveness, only caring for one's own, selfishness, or however you want to say it. But after a rhetorical assertion of everyone being one family, she takes care to point out this doesn't mean that we take care of each other the way we would a real child, parent, or sibling, by sharing food, making space in our homes, visiting each other when circumstances force us apart, etc. This is her second quote. I don't believe you can equate feelings of religion with feelings about people here illegally. You can put quotes around that word, illegal, but in reality, laws are being broken if you sneak into a country uninvited. The only way I see our religion having anything at all to do with feelings about illegal immigrants is maybe being willing to be more compassionate about the plight of people in countries who are struggling. Her understanding of kinship seems to be that our real family, that is, nuclear or birth family, claims literal relationships that extend to specific material obligations, like breastfeeding, driving a child to school, a couple's pooled finances for a home mortgage, etc. But relationships of universal family remain in the metaphorical, or at best, the emotional realm, provoking only sympathy and sacrament meeting talks, removed from any specific material commitment to their well-being. 4. Vertical and horizontal kinship. There are two basic idioms of Mormon kinship, I think, which I will call vertical and horizontal. Vertical families are tracked genealogically, from ancestor to descendant and specific lineages, the way we're used to tracking last names and inheritances and recessive congenital diseases. The fundamental relationship in vertical families is the parent-child bond, descending like a ladder from earliest or most prominent progenitor to newest infant. Vertical families are the creation of mortality, as unique spirit intelligences enter, and 9 months later exit, the real flesh and blood wombs of women, changing from undifferentiated children of God to clearly categorized members of particular family trees. Horizontal families are universal. Everyone is everyone else's spirit brother or spirit sister, even Satan and Jesus. The fundamental relationship in horizontal families is the sibling bond, suggesting a fundamental and universal equality that began in the pre-existence, a time before mortal life when all of us were very much together in heaven. Horizontal and vertical idioms coexist simultaneously in Mormon doctrine and rhetoric, but the vertical form seems to dominate in practice, particularly if you look at where people put their time and money. Still, the pre-existence was apparently not the only time when we could be free of clannishness. 4th Nephi, the chapter that depicts the most righteous years in the history of the Book of Mormon peoples, reports, "And it came to pass there was no contention in the land, because the love of God which did dwell in the hearts of the people. There were no robbers nor murderers, neither were there Lamanites, nor any manner of ites, but they were in one, the children of Christ, and heirs to the kingdom of God." My mother-in-law's answer to the same question I asked my aunt about how her experience in the church had affected her views toward illegal migrants demonstrates how one idiom of kinship can be used to dismiss or replace the other. This is the prompt that I had. "I'm writing a paper for class at Vanderbilt Divinity School this weekend. I'm trying to explore a little bit about how the idea of everyone being brothers and sisters in the church, and spirit brothers and sisters as well, affects or could affect Mormons' views on migrants and migration." The response I got: "I don't have much time to write because I'm trying to finish Christmas details while helping Sarah through this difficult pregnancy," Sarah, her daughter. "But my very first thought when I read your email was I can truly say I love people. My father was quite the opposite when it came to blacks, but I didn't buy into his thinking. However, I also believe in obeying the law. We have so many hit-and-run accidents here that it is unbelievable, and it's because many are illegals. Theft is also extreme. Those who are caught, in most instances, have Hispanic names. If someone is going to be an American, they should first and foremost want to obey our laws. Love doesn't have to be blind. Even God has consequences when his laws are broken, though he loves us the most of all. All my ancestors came as legal immigrants through the front door, and I love them for that. Enough said. How are you doing?" That was the end of the email. So there's a couple things I'm going to highlight in there. That last shot, "all my ancestors," remarkably subtle yet pointed rejection of universal kinship. I ask if she believes that everyone is her family, and she responds that by explaining that her ancestors, her family, were law abiders, unlike illegal immigrants. She would never go so far as to actually say those migrants aren't her brothers and sisters. After all, she truly loves all people. Instead, in response to my suggestion of horizontal equality, she emphasizes the vertical relation of family, replacing one idea of kinship with another in order to categorize, divide, and separate herself from them. In case it didn't come clear, I just wanted to emphasize in the beginning of there, in that first paragraph, trying to finish Christmas details, helping her daughter Sarah through a pregnancy. "My father was the opposite." And in each case, replacing a universalist kinship with a vertical and categorized one. 5, a small insurgent siblinghood. "When my father discovered that Victor Lopez had outstayed his visa by several years, he was shocked. Brother Lopez was a house painter from Peru and an active member of my parents' Mormon ward in Alabama. His wife and my mother had been assigned together to be visiting teachers. Then their two elementary school-aged daughters had eaten Christmas dinner with us when I went home from college to visit. My father was impressed by Victor's industriousness. The Lopez family lived in a beautiful home that he had remodeled himself, with furniture he had handcrafted in his time off, and he owned a business that included several employees. To my father, all this suggested an air of respectability, and so when Victor confided he couldn't go back to Peru to visit family for fear of not being able to return, my father could barely believe it." Little bit of background. My father is a military officer that is a lifelong member of the Republican Party. He was a member of the John Birch Society, BYU, etc. So this is context for what is about to happen. Victor's revelation redefined what was at stake in the widespread turmoil over immigration that peaked that year, 2006. My father, a government lawyer, had always held a libertarian bent, but by and large maintains a firm respect for law and order. But his kinship with Victor was suddenly outlawed. His friendship with a brother in the gospel crashed up against his obligation to the law of the land, and the law of the land had buckled first. He started speaking up for migrants' rights and their good character in city council meetings. In his email to me, he wrote this: "As those who are currently in this country illegally and able to provide for themselves, such as the Lopez family, I cannot believe that they, our community, or the nation would be better off by sending them home. On a personal level, while I believe in honoring, obeying, and sustaining the law, and would probably not actively assist someone to enter this country illegally, neither have I nor would I become actively involved in seeking to identify and deport those who are here illegally. I think there's a better way. I do regard the Lopez family as my brothers and sisters in the gospel, and would feel personally diminished and saddened if they were forced to leave the country. They are people of worth, as are many, many more who are here illegally. This is what a gentle Mormon radicalization looks like. This is how our fellow Mormons can become empathetically sensitized to the suffering of strangers, to the pedagogy of kinship, and the liberal urge to expand its lessons to others. It isn't the kind of radicalization that traditional revolutionaries pine for. It's no open insurrection against the government, no systematic critique of coercion or capital, not a declaration of insurgency or even any promise of a refusal to compromise in the future. Instead, it's quiet, a meek refusal to accept the tyranny of the state, in one case, when it becomes just a little bit too much to stomach, and a decision to choose friendship and family instead. That's the end of the paper, so I've got a couple of things to follow up on here. One is that my father, at the end of his email, noted to me, I've done quite a bit of rambling, he's saying in his email, because unlike most issues facing our country, immigration and illegal immigrants may evoke one response intellectually and another emotionally. I believe in the rule of law and the value of enforcing righteous laws. I also believe the best way to ensure we have a just society is to enact good laws as opposed to breaking existing ones. I also believe in compassion and loving our neighbors as ourselves. I know this is not very coherent, since it involves more how I feel than how I think. David Schneider, in 1980, at University of Chicago, wrote a book called Critique of the Study of Kinship, in which he defines family love as diffuse and enduring solidarity. In the anthropology literature, people often refer to fictive kin, which is a term I find funny, because it seems to imply there are several kinds of kin. There's blood kin, where you're genetically related, and there's fictive kin, where you make it all up. I'd argue that all kin are fictive kin. That's not a bad thing. That all children are adopted children. All siblinghood has to be consistently and ritually maintained in order for it to continue to exist. And that's what happened with my father and brother Lopez. Not that he recognized the constructed nature of all kinship, he would never agree with that, but that he adopted a fictive set of siblings into his ring of enduring solidarity. The last point I'm going to make is about a couple of examples of within the family structure, ways that we can think about this, because as we all know, families are not necessarily egalitarian or friendly places. And I certainly don't want to dismiss that reality that a lot of us live. One, I want to talk about siblinghood for just a second. Usually when I write and talk about this, I use the term universal siblinghood rather than universal kinship, because I think it's the most fertile and compelling and relatable family model for solidarity between strangers. The key of this, I think, is that there's a constant tension for siblings between similarity and difference. If we're raised in the same home by the same parents under relatively similar conditions, identical rules, the same covenant of the gospel, you'd think the similarity of training would have some profound effects. Ultimately, siblinghood is assumed to be just about as similar as you can be to somebody. And yet, as we all know and recognize daily, we end up being surprisingly and painfully different. We end up wanting different things. And so the sibling relationship, I think, is the primordial relationship that many Christians use as an indicator of equality, why we call each other brother and sister, and why you look through the Journal of Discourses in the 1880s, and they specifically denounce the use of sir and ma'am, and instead we should use brother and sister because we're all equal, as a rejection of class relations. The second is, this is not to say sibling relationships are necessarily egalitarian. There's lots and lots of good literature about how people's ranking into hierarchies is primarily trained through sibling relationships and birth order. There's a lot of that too. For some reason, we in Mormonism tend to emphasize the egalitarian element, so I think it's great. Spouses is the second one, because I think that spouses really recognize the creation of kinship ties, the recognition that equality is possible even between different sorts of people, didn't grow up together, don't necessarily have the same points of view, and a recognition that social models and boundaries can change. Everybody, every Mormon knows this. Everybody believes this, which is amazing, right? Because if you talk about solidarity between people, the immediate response that you'll tend to get, I think, is that those people are different and that's hard. It's hard to get along with people that are different. And yet the spousal relationship, I think, suggests that people fundamentally understand that this is possible. I think we need to work on that. And yet, until recently, the 20th century, inequality between spouses was presumed until recently, it was basically accepted that women would be inevitably subordinate to men, and that was just the nature of it when men and women came together. And yet now, although there's still plenty of work to do on this, it's generally assumed, I think, the opposite. That people can, at least, be equally yoked. The third I'm going to mention to finish out is the parent-child relationship, which is a really interesting one because, obviously, parent-child relationships are what a lot of us really wish to avoid, right? Like, the president as the father of the nation who gets to order us around like a child, right? Treating us like children. It's a problem. And yet, the parent-child relationship, I think, clearly is the experience that every single individual fundamentally has had years and years of experience in an anti-capitalist economy that you actually share with people, not because you're invested in them, or maybe you are, but that the investment is approaching an infinite return in terms of length of time. I'll end there. So I'm going over a little bit. Thank you.
While I introduce Fernando, why don't we just stretch really quick? Just give a good stretch in between. This last talk, and hopefully we'll have about 10 minutes for discussion, is part of an ongoing idea or column or series in the Mormon Worker. We like to call A People's History of Mormonism, after the famous book by Howard Zinn. We're trying to tell the story of radical Mormons and the history of Mormonism that aren't recognized. Fernando Gomez is an amateur writer and an avid Mormon historian. Born in Monterrey, Nuevo León, he has traveled extensively and now lives in Provo. He graduated from BYU in 1967. For the past 20 years, he has operated a nonprofit museum of Mexican Mormon history open to the public without charge across the street from the Mexico City LDS Temple that received more than 12,000 visitors each year. He recently set up an extension of the museum in Provo, Utah, which I've seen. It's wonderful. And the museum is responsible for publishing many books. He and his wife, Enriqueta, have 4 children and 16 grandchildren.
Thank you. I don't know if I should stand up or... Yeah. Lacanati is a very interesting person, but there's very little documented history about him. And what I'm going to show you is a research that we've been doing for many, many years, and it's not conclusive. I will be reading most of it.
The top line's cut off.
Right. The subject matter that I will present is far from being conclusive. We, the Museum of Mormon Mexican History, have been trying to find the relationship of Rodacanati to Mexican Mormonism for many years. He was the first baptism that took place on November of 1879 in Mexico City. He was the first to receive the Melchizedek priesthood and the first branch president in Mexico to preside over the first LDS branch in December of 1879. Secular and LDS records are sketchy with respect to his origin or his activity in the church. Nevertheless, he was the spark that brought LDS missionaries to Mexico City to officially start the work. There are several opinions as to his nationality, but in a poem published in the newspaper El Socialista on June 18, 1876, with the title Plotino C. Rodacanati, Greco Socialista, indicates that he was born in Greece. At the bottom of the poem, one finds the words E.G. Aguila Mormon. E.G. in Spanish means Greek writer, which apparently he was from Greece. The use of the word Mormon in 1876 is prior to Daniel W. Jones sending Trozos Selectos, which was the first Book of Mormon, from Chihuahua to prominent persons in the Republic. During the late 1840s, the Mormons were abandoning Nauvoo. At the same time, John Taylor was called to serve a mission in Europe, and in 1850 was in France. In July, John Taylor participated in a debate with Protestant ministers about Mormonism in the city of Bologne in France. This certainly must have received great publicity. When John Taylor visited Cobbett in Paris in the summer of 1850, he was the communist Icarian leader who was busy trying to salvage his first colony by moving it from Texas to Nauvoo. In May of 1847, Cobbett published in Paris a book about the history of Mormonism. John Taylor's mission to France was for the purpose of establishing the LDS Church in that country. It was at this time that John Taylor made an acquaintance with Louis A. Bertrand, who was the editor of the socialist newspaper owned by Cobbett called the Popular. Bertrand published several articles about the Mormons in the newspaper in 1849 and 1850. These newspapers indicated that Mormon colonies were successful and had a great future. In 1850, at the age of 22, Rodacanati traveled to Paris, where he was exposed to the ideas of Hegel, Fourier, Proudhon, and Cobbett. His objective was to meet with Poda. It is very likely that during the visit of Rodacanati to France in 1850, he heard about the Mormons and became interested in their accomplishments as well as in the socialist movement that was taking place in France. It is possible that he could have read the newspapers about the debate that John Taylor had in Bologne, France, and also the articles in the newspaper, the Popular, and became familiar and liked the accomplishments of the Mormons. Bertrand was baptized on December 1st, 1850 by John Taylor, and became part of the first branch of the LDS Church in Paris. He was ordained a priest. He helped in the translation of the Book of Mormon in French, and the book was published in 1852. Rodacanati established himself in Paris, France, in 1857, and lived there until 1860. He pursued his ideas about colonization. It is said that by 1860, he published in Paris the pamphlet De la Naturaleza, and became aware of the decree of the Mexican president Ignacio Comonfort, which favored the establishment of agrarian colonies on Mexican territory. The benefits established under said decree attracting him to moving to Mexico. However, Bertrand is called to be mission president in Paris, France in 1859 and is there until 1863. Is it possible that during that time, Rodacanati made contact with Bertrand or read more material about the Mormons, since Bertrand continued to publish additional articles on the subject? By late 1860, Rodacanati traveled to Barcelona and then set sail to Mexico, arriving in Veracruz in late February of 1861, and a few days later to Mexico City. He was a stranger in a new land, probably low on funds, but having medical knowledge as well as several languages, he began to make money and move on with his plans to establish an academic roundtable and an agrarian colony. In 1861, he wrote Cartilla Socialista and began propagating the ideas of contemporary European thinkers. Particularly, he organized this society and this newspaper. It indicates that he was soliciting a place for the academy to take place. And those are papers from the 19th century. The newspaper of Siglo XIX on January 23, 1886, reported that Rodacanati had established an academy called La Arquedia Mexicana. In 1853, Bertrand was serving as a missionary in Jersey. While there, he taught Victor Hugo, but in Bertrand's assessment, Hugo was too full of revolution to think much about the gospel of Jesus Christ. Perhaps Rodacanati was more receptive. After his mission ended in 1863, he returned to Salt Lake City and lived there until his death in 1875. Could he have met Melitón Trejo and talked about Rodacanati while the Book of Mormon was being translated? Melitón González Trejo was helping in the translation of the book. In order to support himself, Rodacanati found employment at a school in Mexico City and began to organize like-minded students. A circle of followers emerged, including Santiago Villanueva, Francisco Zalacosta, Julio Chavez López, and Jose Maria Gonzalez. These people and others would later form a nucleus in the early Mexican labor and peasant movement. Somehow, Rodha Canati received a copy of Trozos Selectos del Libro de Mormón and wrote several letters to church leaders, the first in 1878. And in this one, he says, having read a Spanish translation of the Mormon Bible, which has found its way down here. And then it also says that there's no Mormon missionaries in Mexico and that there's perfect religious toleration in Mexico at that time. A second letter dated December 15, 1878 indicates he read to us a work titled Trozos Selectos del Libro de Mormón. Therefore, this and other considerations that we have profoundly meditated upon in our souls have driven us by a divine notion not only to embrace such doctrine in theory, but also to practice it. Even more important, to make ourselves, despite our humble social positions, to consider ourselves honored and willing workers and worthy ministers or pastors of your holy creed. Officially requesting by means of the eminent and tireless propagator of the faith, our respected and beloved brother, Melitón G. Trejo, an elder of the church. This is an interesting because why would Rodha Canati call Melitón González Trejo an eminent and tireless propagator of the faith, our respected and beloved brother and elder of the church? He knew too much about him somehow. Okay? We don't know how. As early as 1878, why did Rodha Canati correspond with Melitón in 1876 or 77? Either Trejo visited Mexico City or he met Louis Bertrand in Utah after receiving a pamphlet in France in 1872, and he told him about Rodha Canati in Mexico City, Stover south of the border indicates. In the hope of gaining his desire, Melitón requested assignment to the Spanish military forces in the Philippines. This request was granted in 1872. While passing through France, Melitón came into possession of a small pamphlet written by Elder Louis Bertrand. Reading this gave Melitón additional information about the saints and their religion. Moses Thatcher, the apostle who opened the work in Mexico City in 1879, wrote, Dr. Plotino Cerro de Canati called upon and gladly and warmly welcomed us to Mexico. He it is who had been communicating with President Taylor and Council since November of 1878, regarding our holy religion in which he is a believer. I was favorably impressed with his appearance and with his open, frank, warm-hearted manners. There have been some 15 or 20 believers in the gospel, as revealed in the latter days, who have occasionally met together and talked to one another about our doctrines, and within 2 or 3 months have been publishing a monthly paper. It was called La Voz del Desierto. And it's interesting to know there was a branch that was organized prior to the missionary, because it's Organo de la Rama Mexicana, which is a part of the branch, and in which they have advocated the principles of the gospel of Christ. And if we were to read all of these documents, we would find a lot of the Mormon doctrine prior to the missionaries arriving in Mexico City, translating and publishing extracts from the Voice of Warning and other church works. This is the translation of the Voice of Warning was made with the help of Rodha Canati. So we must confirm that Rodha Canati had communication with Melitón González Trejo, who had settled in Tres Alamos in southeastern Arizona, where in 1878 he received letters from Rodha Canati in Mexico City, who had acquired one of the Book of Mormon pamphlets sent out from Chihuahua by Daniel W. Jones 2 years before. I don't know how he found out where Trejo was, but at any rate, they entered into correspondence, and Rodha Canati said that he wanted to learn more about the church. This is from Opening Wedge by Gordon Irving. The church sent Moses Thatcher, who arrived in Mexico City in November of 1879, and his priority was to meet with Rodha Canati. Thursday, November 20, 1879, Thatcher reports, I entered the water first by means of stone steps and was followed by Rodha Canati, with a watery element surrounding our bodies from just below the armpits and with a clear blue sky of heaven above us on which the sun was shining brightly. And while all nature was smiling around us and I believe angels were rejoicing above, I baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, The first person ever baptized in this part of the world by the authority of the holy priesthood since the days of the Nephites, when Jesus gave authority to baptize. This person was Plotino Constantino Nati. We then turned to the residence of Brother R, and we three, others, Stuart, Trejo, and I, laid our hands upon the head of each of the brethren in order of their baptism and confirmed them members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I pronounced blessing and ceremony of confirmation, the Spirit of God resting richly upon me and indicating many glorious promises in behalf of this brethren if they remain humble and pure before the Lord. In the 1870s were years of great activity for Radakanati. Politics, the effort to make known his ideas, and the formation of groups where he gathered his followers in order to instruct them. He also welcomed the first Mormon missionaries to Mexico City, but he also provided time for enriching his personal life. In 1877, he was deeply touched, and the press made known his romantic passion in a poem dedicated to Ida, whom he called his soulmate. Ida, que bellos son tus ojos, how beautiful your eyes. When your beautiful eyes darted toward mine by means of that fascinating look, you communicated all the strength of your intelligence, all the enchantment of your love. We do not know if Plotino and Ida were married, but we do know that he had an infant son 27 months after the poem was written. Radakanati's son blessed by Moses Thatcher on Thursday, November 20, 1879, which is recorded as follows. We three, Trejo, Stuart, and Thatcher, took it to our arms, the infant son, the brother R, and blessed it, giving it the name of Nephi Moses, which shall stand together in the house of the Lord and perform ordinances for the redemption of his forefathers. That's the name recorded by the church, but his name was not. We think that because we found a memento that had Plotinito, which I think belonged to his son. So I think he took the name of the father. But discouraged because of his ideas versus church policy, by May 1881, he was accused of printing an article in the newspaper La Reforma Social, critical of the Mormons. By August of 1881, Fairmont Young, a missionary, reports, meeting was held in a room number 10, Segunda Calle de San Francisco. Radakanati's resignation as president of the branch was read and accepted. The last Mormon contact with Radakanati is found in the diary of Hilleman Pratt, dated May 14, 1886, which reads, in company with Brother Stuart, Arteaga, and Perez will become an important individual, call on Brother Radakanati to say whether he wished to continue to be known as a member of the church and urging on him the necessity to attend to his duties. The visit was just 3.5 months after the press reported Radakanati's last secular accomplishment, the establishment of the Arcadia Mexicana on January 22, 1886. To complicate matters, there are two Mexican mission Spanish publications that mention Radakanati. These are both church related, one in 1938, the other one in 1942. And it tells the story again of what I've been talking about. But this one is a very interesting. This is a magazine that was published by a segment of a division that occurred in Mexico in 1836 to 1846. And it's in the title of it is When and How the Gospel of Our Lord Jesus Christ Came to Mexico. And it's by Elder Armando Perez, who was one of the first converts. And in these red lines, he knew him from 1878 onwards until 1941. He died in 1938. But he called him Riquelme, which is another apostle in the whole picture. Armando Perez was one of the first baptists in Mexico City under the influence of Radakanati. He indicates that Radakanati had a second name, Francisco Riquelme. Armando Perez was born on February 8, 1857 and died on January 16, 1940. During the encounter that he relates, he was 21 years old. He was baptized 18th of December, 1879 at the age of 23. And it even gets even more complicated. In 1987, Sister Mayra Riquelme, the name comes again, wife of Hiram Rualcaba, alumni from Benemérito de las Américas and BYU, visited the museum in Mexico City. During the tour given by Sergio Palaza, museum director, Sister Rubalcaba indicated that she has family ties to Rodacanati, indicating that he had changed his name to Riquelme due to death threats he had received. This seemed to agree with the statement given by Armando Perez in 1941 in the magazine Sendero La Manita. The museum kept in touch with Sister Rubalcaba during the following months. One day we received notice from her that one of her uncles had died. She informed me that in a large suitcase that belonged to her uncle, they had found original books written by Rodacanati and other documents in his handwriting. We went immediately to their home in Ciudad Satélite, and in this manner we were able to rescue these documents from Rodacanati. With this, we believe, are in his handwriting. And there's a total of 12. And if you read them, one of the papers that were recently written by Moses Thatcher contains part of this particular writing. And these are the books that are nowhere to be found. People have looked for them, they just can't find the books. But we were able to at least copy the covers of the books. Copies have been made available to several scholars and students for their research. We wrote a book in 1997, El Águila Mormón, o El Anarquista Cristiano, by Rodacanati. And then Carlos Hinale, a professor at one of the universities in Mexico City, wrote this book, Rodacanati and the Formation of the Socialist Thinking in Mexico. And he received a prestigious award from the Mexican government. The use of the word Mormon in 1876 is prior to Daniel W. Jones sending Trozos Electos from Chihuahua to prominent persons in the Republic. Why did he use it? Did Rodacanati make contact with John Taylor or Louis Bertrand in Paris in France in 1850? Why did Rodacanati call Melitón Getrego the eminent and tireless propagator of the faith, a respected and beloved brother? Did he know it? Did Bertrand and Trejo have an opportunity to get together in Salt Lake City in 1874 or 75 when the Book of Mormon was being translated? Armando Perez was with Rodacanati in 1877 when they found the book, Trozos Electos del Libro del Mormón, and with Gilliman Pratt in 1886 when they asked him if he wanted to continue as a member of the church. Did he know him better than anybody else? Why did he insist in calling him Riquelme or Rodacanati? How was the uncle of Mayra Riquelme able to maintain original documents, books, and other mementos? Why did Rodacanati not take them to Europe if he did go there? Among the items was a memento with the inscription of Plotinito, which we believe was the real name of the son blessed by Moses Thatcher. The museum believed he was killed shortly thereafter. Of course, we have no proof yet.
What does Trozos Electos mean in English? Is it four sheets?
It's a selection.
What selection was it? Was it Third Nephi? Was it
no,
the first part of the book?
It starts with Third Nephi. There's four books that are part of the book.
The first four of the book?
No. It skips through the book.
But you don't think the Third Nephi section was in it?
There's parts of the Third Nephi.
Was it about the social equality that's mentioned in the Third Nephi?
I don't remember. I would have to be
honest.
I don't know, but we could analyze it.
All right.
But he was definitely socialist.
Oh, well.
Okay? And we think the relationship between Bertrand, who was very socialist because he worked for Cabot, and the fact that he converted to Mormonism, and the fact that he came to Salt Lake, and the fact that he went back as mission president, we think there's a relationship, but of course nothing is written. So all of this are just ideas.
Thank you very much. We do have some time for discussion, so I'd like to stretch one more time, and then, I guess we have about 10 minutes for discussion. So just real quickly, to give the opportunity, should be fine. Let's just go with questions. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you all for those very interesting and important presentations. My question is for Katie. Katie, I very much agree with the basic premises of your argument about the importance for nurturing, in every sense of that word, for a feminist perspective. What I'm wondering is if you thought through, you talked about how this desire of yours to have a farm and to, you know, get, be able to produce food and so forth. Have you thought at all about the problem or the mechanism of dealing with different gifts? I mean, I agree with you that we all need to nurture, whether we're male, men, or women. We need to think about how we affect the earth. None of us should see ourselves as above any kind of menial job. I always feel that if you're not willing to clean the toilet, you know, then, you know, that's, every job is an important part of society. But I also feel that the nurturing of the mind and the spirit are very important. I'm thinking of Tolstoy, who I'm trying to remember if I have a quick memory of this, that he sort of rejected his earlier writings of Anna Karenina and War and Peace, and yet I'm so glad he wrote those books, right? For me, they feed my soul. I remember the 1970s having little children, and I was going to grow my food. I remember a summer where I had 80 tomato plants, and I canned, and I had grape juice, and I was going to make all my clothes from recycled material. And I kind of gave up because I couldn't both take care of my kids, do all of this kind of work, and also teach, which is very important to me. So, I mean, do you believe in a community, or have you worked out the idea of, you know, can I... Do we all have to do every job, or is there a way in which we can share gifts?
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Margaret, both for your question right now and for all of your tireless, incredible work. I think what you're stating is what I want more in the world in life. But I don't know if it's something that we can just begin right now and say, okay, everyone do what they want to do, because there's some people who are so overwhelmingly burdened with doing the dirty work for everyone else. And so I think what it will look like to transition to a community where everyone can actually do what they feel in their heart they're compelled to do and what they have the gift to do, it would require a lot of us doing really difficult things that it feels wrong because we're being stripped of the privilege to spend most of our time not making our food or not dealing with our own waste that we are creating. I do think, as someone who studies philosophy and literature and who cares deeply about the environment and about other species, I hate the philosophy and literature that comes out of people's minds who have not been dealing with physical reality. And I think that the most beautiful and compelling and real writing and thought comes out of people who know how to use their bodies and who actually watch other species and how they behave, rather than just chanting off our cliches about how they live. So, I mean, I do think that it's possible that those can exist. And I do think it's going to be extremely difficult for a lot of us to get to the point where those can exist with ease. And you cited the word community, which I think is huge. I couldn't be thinking of this without sort of a Mormon worker community who are willing to be doing this with me to feed the goats when I needed to go to a conference to present on something, you know, or to take care of the children when I needed to be doing something else, and vice versa.
I really loved all of your presentations and felt really inspired by them. Thank you. I want to ask Corey two questions. For what was the essence for Tolstoy of his conversion? What, if that changed his life, what was it about it? What meant conversion? What had been in his life? And secondly, what was his heresy for which he was excommunicated?
Can we invite
you
to come down to the mic? All of you, I'm sure we have a small.
It's really not working. I don't understand.
I think it's working.
My real question is which one gets recorded.
I don't know why it just stopped working.
Yeah. Okay.
You guys can send them. even if you don't give the application.
Okay. So your first question is just...
What was conversion? It changed his life and saved him from committing suicide. Maybe he thinks, what did that mean to him to convert?
Well, his conversion basically was really just a conversion to Christianity, and to him that meant that he started giving away like a lot of his ownership over like his property. He started sharing his property with peasants, which created conflict in his marriage. He started giving away. To him, he took the Sermon on the Mount literally. Am I answering your question?
So a lot of people talk about conversion as, you know, accepting Jesus as your Savior, or getting a testimony, or da 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 da. But for him, it seems like it was an ethical commitment or something of that sort. That's...
We had that spiritual...
Well, you know, a book called My Conversion, I Believe My Conversion, where he writes about that, and how he was super depressed and wanted to kill himself and die, and like was completely dissatisfied with living his rich lifestyle, you know, as a Russian aristocrat or whatever. And he has his conversion, and to a true Christianity, Paul still does, a true conversion to a true Christianity, which is living an idealistic life of taking Christ serious and trying to solve the problems of the world by reacting with them, like starting a farm or starting a community, announcing his riches, announcing war, announcing an idea, giving up your agency to be in the military. It's like someone was writing, it's like a book called The Kingdom of God is Within You, and just as a whole announcement of the military. I mean, so I think he had like a spiritual experience where he really felt a conversion to Christianity.
Was it a conversion also to the idea of being a priest?
Oh yeah, that's
so right. Maybe that was part of the heresy too.
Right, and that's why he was labeled a heretic, is because after his conversion, it became a very literal thing. So it was the idea that you had to live the Sermon on the Mount literally, and so he started teaching the peasants, because there were peasants surrounding Yasnaya Polyana, which was his homestead, and he started teaching them that the church was kind of basically, telling them lies in order to keep them oppressed, and so the church saw that as heresy.
One last question.
Oh dear.
Well, I'm a bit cynical, as you can imagine, after things that have happened to me. So let me just ask this briefly. Corporations start with the idea of manufacture and profit, and then they slip to exploitation. The nation state starts, a democratic nation state, starts with Lockean ideas that were embodied by the founding fathers, and then slips toward fascism or Stalinism. And the tribe, the clan, the family, slips toward the mafia. And I see this happen so that those structures don't help to protect the people in them from that tendency. And so you've written wonderful papers. I think they're not only a window into ideas that we don't often hear, but also into your own high intelligence. And they provide a new, exciting way of irritating the leaders of the church. But I'd like you to address, what are the principles, and what is it that could keep the family, the nation state, or the corporation from slipping into these authoritarian, destructive modalities?
First, I would say that I don't think that the state and the family and the corporation started benevolently. I think that they were intentional. They began with exploitation. Now, that's a historical question with each individual, whether we'd have to test empirically. But, and so, for me, at least, the question is not, in some ways, the typical Sunstone question, right? What does the church actually lead us towards, or something like that? For me, that question does not have an answer. The question much more so than, wait, if we're really good Mormons, then we'll all treat each other like siblings. That's not in any way what I mean to suggest, because I don't think that that's the right way of thinking about it personally. I think that rather, for me, for example, what I'm suggesting with kinship is that there's very particular experiences and relationships
which then people can apply. So what I consider sort of the pedagogy of experience. And I think that those experiences that people have are much more important to me than the principles that they appear to be or that they are supposedly reinforcing or creating or something like that. And I want to make very clear, I don't think that any of these structures that we're talking about, whether a commune or a family or any of those things, necessarily lead to treating each other well. And that any of those concepts lead us inevitably or even necessarily predominantly towards the good, but rather that they're particularly useful ways of talking about our experience and remembering our experience and how we apply it. For me.
To wrap up, but let's continue the conversation.